Hi, I'm Sanjay, and I'm a serial entrepreneur for the kicks, and I also invest in startups.
And I'm Shannon, a recent college grad working on building my first company.
And this is Startup Days,
the show where we take a behind-the-lens look at starting and growing a company from the perspective of founders and investors.
Welcome to another episode of Startup Days. This time we've got Alex and Ruwan from Replantable on the podcast. Welcome, guys.
Great to be here.
Good to have you all. I've known you guys for a good number of years now at this point, and I find you all have kind of a fascinating story. But I want to start earlier than that. I want to kind of hear about you guys first individually, kind of where you're from, born and raised, all that kind of stuff. So, Alex, let's start with you. Tell us your story.
Yeah, I was born in Philadelphia in the 90s, early 90s.
Early 90s?
Early 90s.
So you're a millennial? Is that
yes? I am a
right?
millennial. Okay. I don't know how to use social media. I barely have a Facebook.
I think
account.
That means you fail as a millennial.
I did. I'm sorry.
You have to turn in your card.
I will. I'll give it to you. Throughout high school, I did a bunch of sciencey type things. I did robotics. I had a robotics club run in my basement. So I became an engineer. Went to Georgia Tech.
So you're good at math.
Good at math.
Of course.
I haven't done math in a while outside of simple modeling and stuff.
Calculating 20% tip on
things. Pretty good at that. I can do that pretty fast now. But when I was at Tech, I did a bunch of entrepreneurial stuff. Of course, I took Startup Lab. I don't think you were in that at the time.
I don't think so, yeah.
It was the first class. But I was part of a few different startups. I don't know if you've heard of like Sanguina.
Yeah.
You have? Okay.
So funny enough, Sanguina is based here now at Prototype Prime.
Is Erica here?
Yeah.
Okay.
She just joined a little while ago.
That's crazy.
I had no idea that you were part of that.
Yeah, I helped develop their, I was the person that developed their app for that.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Oh, that's crazy.
Weird full circle here.
Yeah.
We'll have to go see if we can hunt her down a little bit.
Yeah, I'd like to see her.
So what was your first entrepreneurial experience?
I think that was the first real one I had.
So it was in college. Did you do anything entrepreneurial as you were growing up? Like,
I briefly mentioned I did start my own robotics team, which is quite an undertaking.
This was in high school?
Yeah, this was in 10th grade. I got funding from Lockheed Martin.
You got funding from Lockheed Martin?
I did, yes.
How did you get funding from Lockheed Martin?
Well, we had a family friend who worked for Lockheed Martin as part of their outreach program. So we kind of were like, hey, Paul.
Hook us up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a little more involved than that. But
how much did you score from Lockheed?
Over the few years that we did it, it was probably around $5,000.
That's solid.
Which was pretty exciting as a high schooler.
Yeah.
And we ran a few robotic competitions off of that. We did first. We did some firefighting maze competition at Penn State. And we did combat robots.
Okay. So, Ruwan, tell us your story.
Yeah, sure. So I was born in Minneapolis. Moved shortly after to Philadelphia. Was born, so I was raised there. And
so you only spent a little bit of time in Minneapolis.
Yeah, I was like 2.5.
Okay.
When my parents moved us to Philly, and oddly enough, I didn't meet Alex in Philly, even though we were both, you know, raised there.
Really?
Yeah, we actually met at Georgia Tech.
Wow.
Yeah, like the first day, I guess. So that's interesting.
Was that total luck that you met at? It was during Facet.
Yeah, during, like, the orientation,
Yeah, okay. Just total luck, though? They didn't, like, group you off, like, hey, you Philly kids are over there or anything?
Yeah, I guess, geographically, we were in the same group for orientation, so there's that. But that also includes, you know, that probably thousands of people. So.
All the Northeast or something?
Yeah, basically all of the Northeast.
Okay. Facet has changed quite a bit since...
Yeah, well, so Alex and I have been friends for a while. We knew each other through college, mostly worked on, you know, projects and stuff together. Alex mentioned he was in Sanguina, the startup. I was actually part of a startup my sophomore year in college, too. It was called Intuitive Pickups. It was they were developing a new type of pickup for acoustic guitars.
Okay. And was that your first entrepreneurial or startup experience, or had you done... Were you selling anything illicitly in school?
Not that I can talk about.
Fair enough. But so that was the first time you'd done anything like that?
Yeah, that was really my first entrepreneurial experience.
Okay.
I was kind of hired on as their engineer, you know, and by engineer, I they meant I would be in a shed soldering electronics.
Nobody all else summer. Knew how to solder. Is that what it was?
Yeah, sort of. Yeah. You know, building MVPs, prototypes, kind of right. thing. Yeah.
Well, that I think has set you up well for kind of what we're going to talk about coming up now. But there's another interesting kind of interconnection between the two of you in terms of birthdays.
Oh, yeah. Our birthdays are a few days apart.
5 days apart.
Yeah. Yeah. In the same year. So
that is so weird.
Yeah.
Both from Philly. Both went to Georgia Tech 5 days apart. Kind of feel like it's destiny at this point, right?
It must be, honestly.
You need to find like 3 or 4 other people to fill out those other birthdays in between. They have to also be from Philly.
It's a tall order.
That Venn diagram is probably pretty small about how many people from Philly in those dates that are engineers.
Do you think your personalities are too similar, though? Because you're the same horoscope sign, I'm guessing, right?
I knew that's where you were going, Shannon.
I think we have quite a bit of differences.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. If anything, our skills are a little too similar. We can probably get into that later with how that applies to the startup. But
let's actually mention that. So what were your majors at Georgia Tech?
I was a biomedical engineer.
And Ruan?
And for me, mechanical engineering, yeah.
So both engineers, but you're not doing anything biomedical now.
We are focusing on some biology, though. I do a lot of bio research. Okay. A lot of what I do involves researching like studies that talk about how to grow plants in weird environments, because that's what we do.
Okay. So you guys came into the CreateX, what did we call it back then? Startup Summer program?
Mm-hmm.
It's now called Startup Launch in 2015. And your original idea was what again?
Oh, man. Okay.
That you came into.
Yeah. So when we applied to the program, our idea was a new transportation method for produce from farms to like grocery stores.
Right.
Basically, instead of cutting it on the farm, harvesting it essentially, you pull it up with the roots. And we had these little packages that you clip around the roots and it would keep it alive all the way to the consumer.
And the reason why you wanted to keep it alive was because?
It would just be a lot fresher. It would last longer. You wouldn't end up wasting a bunch of produce like, you know, most people do now.
But y'all also said that you wouldn't then need to refrigerate it, right?
Oh, yeah, that too. Yeah, exactly. Refrigeration accounts for a lot of the energy use in moving produce around the country.
And your theory here was the reason why farmers couldn't produce more is because refrigerated trucks were expensive. And doing all that was a pain, and so that's how you were going to get around it, right? That was a theory.
Well, it's kind of,
if I remember correctly,
it's kind of the opposite of that. More than half the fruits and vegetables in this country are thrown away because of waste, and if you can keep them alive until they're consumed, you can actually grow half of what we're growing now, fruits and vegetable wise, which would save a lot of space, energy, and resources.
So you guys had come up with a packaging solution for plants to ship them live. So what happened?
Well, actually, it's funny because the way you phrased it, you said, so we'd be solving a problem for farmers, right? Like, and we didn't really think about it that way. So that's kind of the problem. We thought, you know, fresher produce, you know, that's great. Everyone's going to love that.
Yep.
Farmers are going to love that, you know. But it actually doesn't really matter to the farmer too much. You know, the consumer is the main one that's going to benefit from this technology.
Okay.
But who has to buy the packages? The farmer.
Yeah.
And what do the farmer's margins look like? You know, just a few cents per head of lettuce. So they can't be buying like a package that's 25 cents more per head
right.
of lettuce.
Especially if they can't pass that cost on.
Exactly.
Right. And that's what you found. You couldn't pass that cost on to the consumer? Or what was the issue there? Why did that kind of idea fail?
So, I mean, we actually went to talk, and we went and talked to farmers. Like, I shadowed a farmer for a whole day, actually, checking out their operation, you know, seeing how they do things, how they package their produce. Basically, it's, you know, produce has become pretty commoditized. It's a race to the bottom with prices. Even 50 cents more on a case, you know, can mean the sale or make or break the sale to a large grocer. So, there just wasn't a willingness to add extra input costs.
Okay. So from there, where did you guys go? Did you say, okay, we're done. Let's do something else altogether.
Well, we kind of moved down the supply chain. We started looking at grocery stores.
Okay. So you're still stuck on food. So why food though? Why do you, biomedical engineer, mechanical engineer, why do you care about food so much?
Well, we're both pretty into cooking. Alex probably a little more than me.
Yeah, I cook every night. Usually I'll cook dinner for myself and my roommates, and then if I'm feeling bored later, I'll just cook something else later just for the hell of it. So I really love food. I grew up with a garden in my backyard. We always had fresh food, abundance of peppers, tomatoes, just fantastic food. So it's always been an important part of my life. But outside of that, food is something that we all experience, something that we all use. And the system we have is just incredibly wasteful. So we took that to heart and trying to make it easier to give people fresh produce in an environmentally conscious way.
Okay. Okay. So, okay, from shipping plants then, what happened next? You started going down the supply chain, and where'd you hit next?
Right. So as part of our research for that, you know, the initial idea, we had actually talked to a bunch of produce managers at grocery stores. And something that we heard is that there's a lot of loss at the grocery store level. Most of the loss happens at the grocery store level and then in your fridge at home, like at the consumer level. I don't know exactly how the idea came about, but we kind of started thinking about growing in alternate environments, you know, not on the farm, but maybe at the grocery store and maybe on their roof.
Yeah. So, as I dubbed it, roof food.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
You guys were going through this.
It was project code name roof food. it never saw the light of day, so it never got a better name. But
yeah. Yeah. So what happened? You guys started investigating this and.
Right. So I think the first thing we did was we talked to a natural grocery store, who the produce manager actually agreed.
We came in with a render.
Right, a rendering, right. Yeah. We made some like concept renders of how it would look, you know? Right. Like these pallets that would go on the roof. We seed them. We operate it, essentially. And they harvest the food, or they bring it directly down to the produce floor.
So they go up onto the roof, they cut the fruit off, and then they just...
Sell it right downstairs, right. Basically. Okay. Yeah, or live sales to customers.
Okay. So as they need new, it's like just-in-time delivery of produce from your roof.
Exactly. And they can grow maybe the higher value things like the herbs and things like that where they can make a good margin on them. And the economics of it actually looked pretty good with the margins that they could be making and we could be making. So we actually got a produce manager at one of the grocery stores here in Atlanta to say okay tentatively. In the meantime, like a few days after that, we went and talked to a civil engineering professor at Georgia Tech just to run the idea by him, you know, adding farms to roofs. You know, maybe you should talk to an expert in the field.
Yeah.
And he said...
Because you don't want to cave the roof in.
Yes.
And he said, you're going to cave the roof in.
Yeah, basically. There you go. Yeah. We knew where that was going.
And even if you don't, if the roof caves in, not from your own fault, you're going to be blamed.
Yeah, the liability would have been pretty intense. We probably would have had to have each roof certified by, you know,
a structural engineer.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, if you want to put a single pencil on a roof, you know, you have to get it recertified with the extra dead load or whatever, you know. So, yeah, so it's difficult. It had some hurdles. We didn't have a lot of money at the time.
Right.
You know, this is early
days. To willy-nilly go hire structural engineers to do stuff like this.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, funny enough, a few days later, we get a call from that same produce manager saying, hey, I talked to the general manager, and she said no. You're going to cave the roof in. So
was that the concern from the general manager?
Yeah, that was the roof in. Yeah, exactly.
He was really into it, though. He even gave us a tour of the roof. Like we were on top of the roof. He was like, I would want to put it here. He was really into it.
We even mapped like the sun patterns on the roof and everything. So like, you know, I looking back, I definitely see the frictions that we would have run into.
Okay. So, so that put the kibosh on that. Where did you go from there?
At that point, we kind of just threw up our hands and we said like, okay, if we want to get consumers fresher produce, why don't we just let them grow it themselves? But not in the way that, you know, we're used to doing it, where you read about it and buy the seeds and it's a hobby and all of that. We wanted to see if there's a way that it could be, you know, set and forget as easy as a coffee maker or something like that.
So it's interesting, this progression that you've had. So at first you were trying to help the farmers, and then you realize, forget the farmers, we're going to cut them out of the deal. We're going to go straight to the grocery stores. Then you realize, like, well, forget the grocery stores, we're going to cut them out of the deal, and we're going to go straight to the people that are buying. Straight to where the money is.
It's more like we wanted fresher foods ourselves, you know, on our tables and to use in our cooking. And we just had it in our minds so concretely that it has to be grown on a farm, right? Food's grown on a farm.
Right.
So we thought, like, what are solutions that work with the farm? And then we're like, oh, you know, maybe we can go to the grocery store level. But maybe we don't need grocery stores either for produce, you know, if you can grow it right in your house.
Right. Okay. So what's the solution that you devised for that?
We looked into a bunch of different methods for growing. I mean, we had experience with growing in soil, but soil can be difficult for the home. It's messy. You know, you need tools. You need, like, big 50-pound bags of soil and things like that.
And they come with bugs.
Yeah, it introduces bugs in your home.
Bugs in the home,
when
yeah.
When we were testing between doing hydroponics and doing soil, the soil that you brought into your house actually carried some of the bugs, and you had a little bit of an infestation.
And I was reading recently, too, that soil can affect food quality. I don't know if this is something that you guys looked at, but there was a report about heavy metals in, like, sweet potatoes carrots and things like that, and it's all coming from the soil because those things are grown underground.
Yeah, that's a great point. To use soil in a responsible way, you need to be able to test it. Not only that, that also points to another issue with soil is you don't know what's going on, regardless of heavy metals. If your soil is low in nitrogen or potassium or something like that, that's something that it takes a pretty experienced grower to look at the plant and say, oh, that's a nitrogen deficiency, you know? This is what I need to add to the soil to build it. But hydroponics, on the other hand, which is basically just growing without soil, growing straight in water with the nutrients in the water, it's a lot more controllable, and it's a lot easier to make a system where, regardless of where you set it up in the country or, you know, or the experience of the person setting it up, it can always work exactly the same. So it's a lot more controllable.
Okay. Exactly. Okay. Okay. So you guys came up with a device for the home called?
The Nano Farm.
The Nano Farm. Okay. So not a macro farm. It's a nano farm. Integrate that Georgia Tech engineering there at some point into the naming.
And it doesn't involve nanotechnology at all.
No, we get that question a lot.
We get
Do
that
you?
Question. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. A decent amount. I guess the name
you
comes.
You should probably just say yes.
Like, yeah, it's fancy. Yeah, there's a selling point right
well,
there.
Well, we're not marketers.
Yeah.
We're engineers.
We're getting better at it, but the name kind of comes from, like, a micro farm is the smallest type of recognized farm. A micro farm is like a backyard farm.
Okay, so you wanted to go smaller.
It's one step smaller than that. Smaller. Yeah.
Is there going to be a Pico farm after that?
Maybe. Maybe.
Yeah. Okay, so you've got the Nano Farm, and so how does that work?
So basically, the Nano Farm, it's basically a countertop growing system. So You plug it in. It's got growing lights. It's totally enclosed, so it's got its own, like, microclimate or nanoclimate, I should say.
Nanoclimate, yeah, I like that.
And we have these pre-seeded pads. We call them plant pads, and they're made of paper. They've got the seeds and the nutrients already in them.
So you don't need any more soil or anything else like that. It's just the plant pad.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. It's everything that you need to grow all in one pad. And you basically fill the reservoir on the Nano Farm up with water. You put in one of the plant pads, your choice of produce, say a lettuce pad. And in a few weeks, you've got lettuce.
Okay.
There's no touching it in between, you know, setting it up and harvesting. So it makes it pretty easy for people that are busy.
You don't have to water it or anything.
Okay, yeah, because the reservoir holds all the water and that's it. And
because it's an enclosed environment, it is really efficient water-wise. And hydroponics is generally more efficient for water use anyway.
Oh, so you don't have to worry about the evaporation as much or anything else? Okay. Okay. So that reservoir holds enough water for from when you start until when you finish to harvest, right?
Plus a few weeks for time to harvest.
Okay. Okay. And so then once you harvest, then what? What do you do?
Then the pads are biodegradable and compostable. You just swap the old pad out for a new pad, whatever variety you want to try next, and okay. Yeah.
So you just throw it in the garbage, or you throw it in your compost heap if you do that.
Exactly.
So where are we at with the Nano Farm?
We have a few hundred deployed, and we manufacture those here actually in Lithuania.
Okay.
So pretty close to here.
So made in the USA.
Yes, made in the US.
Made by hand. Is there, like, big machines that make these things? Like, how does that work?
It's somewhat of a hybrid process. It's assembled by hand. A lot of the parts are made by machine, CNC operated. tested machines.
Makes sense, so that it's consistent every single time.
Exactly. We do source some parts from China. I won't say that it's 100% manufactured here.
Okay.
The LEDs and power electronics, those come from China.
That but obviously makes sense from China, because where else are you going to get them?
You don't really have much of a choice on some of these components.
There's a company actually not far from us called Nanolumens that makes their LED display systems fully in the U.S., but they actually fabricate everything, and I actually don't know about the LEDs, if they actually do fabricate those, but it's really hard to get a product that is fully made in the USA at this point.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah, but I think it's probably there's probably some percentage that you have to be able to say made in the USA, and I'd suspect your guys is probably that.
Yeah, it's almost 100% made in the U.S. Yeah.
And the farms themselves, do you guys make them here? You make the plant pads here. What about the farms, the nano farms?
That's what I was talking about.
Okay, so those are made here too.
The boxes are made here also.
Okay.
And the plant pads are 100% made here.
Those are handmade.
Okay.
Handcrafted.
Are you like chopping trees down to make the paper? I'm assuming you're buying paper from somebody else.
We're buying pulp from a local pulp manufacturer.
Really?
Yeah.
So you're not even starting with paper. You're starting with pulp.
We're starting with pulp.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then you like bake it into paper?
It's a few different processes.
Whole
yeah.
thing that you do?
It's a whole thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Okay. And so we've got the nanofarm. What else do we have? Is that it? Is that the thing now?
No. We actually do a bunch of things. So there's the nanofarm, and then there's the nanofarm pro.
Pro. I like that.
The pro version.
Fancy. I want a pro version. You know, by the way, I was at the Fixed offices, and they've got a nanofarm.
They do.
John Gattuso over there showed me. He's like, oh, yeah, we've got a nanofarm. I was like, oh, look at that.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a good friend of ours and one of the backers of our Kickstarter. So
there you go.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's a Kickstarter nanofarm.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So what is the nanofarm pro?
So basically, it's a product aimed at commercial kitchens. So we got feedback from some restaurant owners and chefs that they would really like to use nanofarms in their operations. But of course, they need a larger producing capacity. And the cost, the hardware cost of each individual nanofarm was too high at the time to make, you know, buying, say, 10 or 20 nanofarms feasible for a restaurant.
With one nanofarm, how long does it take from planting to actually harvest?
For like full-size lettuce greens, 3 weeks.
Okay, yeah. So that doesn't work for a kitchen, right? Because they're needing stuff every single day.
Yeah, I mean, they're more interested in things like herbs and microgreens anyway.
Okay.
So most of the restaurants that we have are growing microgreens, which are just, you know, the greens you're normally very familiar with. Like we have basil microgreens, 4 different types of basil microgreens, and they grow in 2 weeks instead of the 3 or 4 weeks that a full-size basil takes in our system.
So you do a handful of these, and then you can cycle through them quickly enough.
And you don't use a lot of microgreens because they're very concentrated in flavor.
Right.
So you're kind of like a garnish or just something to add a little color or flavor to the dish.
Okay.
So they can use a whole pad through a lot of different dishes. So it is really more to their speed.
Okay. So you took the nanofarm and then twisted it into nanofarm pro, which is what then?
So the Nanofarm Pro, it has the growing capacity of 20 nanofarms. It uses the same tray, same plant pads, but instead of these like designer-looking boxes, it's like an industrial rack.
Because it's going to be in the kitchen, that's why?
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. You know those like wire racks that shelving units that the restaurants already use? We basically converted one of those into a growing system that holds a bunch of our trays.
Okay, so you've got some of these. So you've got some of these deployed out into kitchens. Do people like it?
Yeah, we do. We have a handful of restaurants here in Atlanta and a handful elsewhere in the country also.
Okay,
mostly high end, fine dining places,
fancy places.
Like Alex said, with microgreens.
Yeah,
typically chef driven, where they're very experimental with the menu and. Chefs really like the aspect of being able to have complete control over the ingredients. They can have anything, any season, they can pick it at any phase of growth. So they can have tiny little greens or like baby greens or, you know, whatever they're looking for.
Or they can get, let it grow a little longer and get something a little bigger, different flavor, different texture.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're telling me when I go into Mel Mushroom, I shouldn't be expecting replantable herbs on the menu there?
No.
Probably not.
I mean, nothing against Mel Mushroom because I love Mel Mushroom, but yeah.
Is there anywhere in Atlanta that you can mention where people could go and potentially eat some replantable food?
Yeah, definitely. Double Zero, the Italian restaurant up in Emery Village.
Gun Show, that's a fantastic restaurant.
Basically you're mentioning places I've never been to or I've never heard of. So any of those places will probably have replantable.
Wrecking Bar? Wrecking Bar's great.
Yeah. Not a millennial. I don't go to those kinds of places.
You don't have to be a millennial to eat great food.
I appreciate great food, too. So live in Gwinnett County, wife.
Yeah, that's
kids,
probably the main issue here.
Okay, so are we now set? Is this the business, or is there more to the story?
So what we've found in making hardware products, the scale that we're making our hardware products in is difficult for reaching price points that people are used to.
Because of that upfront investment on the box and all that stuff?
Exactly.
Okay.
I mean, the NanoFarm runs at $379. That's its retail.
$379.
With free shipping.
With free shipping.
Oh, yeah, that includes shipping.
Two-day Prime delivery straight to your house? No, not Prime.
No.
Not quite.
Not 2 day.
Not 2 day.
If you live close enough to Atlanta, it'll be 2 day, but yeah. Yeah, but the rate that the hardware scales, you know, we'd have to be making, you know, 10,000 nanofarms in a run.
Right.
So we actually had a meeting with Home Depot a long time ago, and I believe they told us that we should be getting it under $79. Was that?
Yes, that was actually the meeting with Bernie Marcus.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so under $79. Right now you're at $379.
Yes.
So you gotta.
We have quite a bit to go.
$300 off of the cost.
I mean, it probably has to be fully made in China to be honest, to reach that kind of price point. But,
yeah. Is that something you're interested in doing or no?
I think we need to think about it. But the thing is, like, we can make it to a much lower price point and still make it here and do all the things that we want to do.
Yeah.
It just takes scale. And that's one thing that we don't have with the hardware right now.
Right.
And then that leads into another factor, right? We talk to a ton of people who are really excited about growing their own food at home.
Uh-huh.
You know, we meet them at demos, at events we have booths at. They're ready to buy a nanofarm on the spot, but that upfront price really prohibits a lot of people from trying it out.
Right.
So probably what, like 6 months ago?
Yeah, that was like a little before summer, I guess. So yeah.
Yeah. So maybe 6 months ago, we started thinking, how can we do the instant growing, you know, the hands-off growing without buying any hardware first? So we had the idea to take, you know, those takeout boxes from a restaurant.
Yeah.
Like those compostable takeout
boxes.
Yeah. And basically,
they have them at Whole Foods, right? That when you get your salad, it's the same thing.
Yeah, that molded pulp kind of box. We basically decided to take one of those and integrate our plant pad onto the top of it.
Okay.
And then choose produce that grows with very little light, just enough light from like a sunny window.
Okay.
If you have a sunny windowsill in your house.
So you don't need the LEDs, you don't need the power, you don't need any of that stuff.
Yeah, you don't need an intense grow light for these varieties. And you can grow a lot of really tasty things like sunflower sprouts, pea shoots, you know, wheatgrass.
Okay.
So we started, our first product right now is a wheatgrass box. So I don't know if you're into the wheatgrass thing.
I'm not a wheatgrass person. Shannon, are you a wheatgrass person?
No, I'm not. But I've kind of been convinced because we were chatting before and I'm kind of convinced to start incorporating some wheatgrass into my diet.
Yeah, you're into spirulina already.
Yeah, so, if you're into spirulina.
This tastes better.
Yeah, I mean, I have a ton of potted herbs on my windowsill, and now I'm thinking all of the bugs that are probably in the soil. And I'm like, what am I going to do about this when I get home?
And you're
today?
Like, ew, I got to spray everything down when I get home. By the way, I've got the marketing genius here for this. It's either the Femto Farm or the Pico Farm. Which one is it?
Okay.
One of those, right?
Okay. Those are good candidates.
Angstrom. We got the Angstrom in between.
Angstrom.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. There you go. Okay. So you've got these. So where are you at on development of this?
So we've actually started shipping already.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And are you making the whole thing? So it's the plant pad, the whole thing. Are you making all in-house again?
We're using a mix of like off-the-shelf components and custom manufacturer.
Okay. So it's like what you learn with the pulp. Are you forming the boxes yourself, or that is that off the shelf?
The boxes are formed. They're off the shelf.
Okay.
So, but we integrate our growing medium onto the top.
Okay.
So onto the lid.
So you're still doing all of that. So once you get this thing, do you end up having to water it all the time, or just water it once, or how does that work?
Just the one time. All you do is you fill the box with water. There's a little fill line inside. You just fill the box up to the fill line.
Uh-huh.
You put the lid on. You set it by a window.
And that's it.
That's it.
Okay.
Okay, where can I buy this?
You've already convinced Shannon.
Well, we are on Amazon. We have a single pack and a five pack. And you mentioned earlier that you sometimes go to Sevenanda. And that's our first brick and mortar retailer.
Very cool.
And is it Prime eligible on Amazon? Oh, so you've got it stocked at a warehouse.
Oh, yeah. A few of them, I assume.
Okay. And that's a little bit of a pain to go through kind of that whole process. So you've kind of figured that whole thing out.
Yeah, it's Amazon makes it pretty straightforward.
Do that. Okay,
I had
good.
Some prior experience to it.
Okay.
So
that's cool. What's the actual name of this product?
We haven't come up with like a name that's going to stick yet. We've been very like MVP about this whole thing.
Okay. But when I go to Amazon and type this in, how do I find it? Like, what do I have to type
in? You can type in replantable.
Okay.
It'll be our only products on there.
Okay.
Actually, the name on Amazon is very clunky, but that's because Amazon is so keyword driven. It's like grow your own greens, easy, self-watering, 100% organic wheatgrass kit.
Yeah, I have it pulled up right now. Self-watering organic wheatgrass kit. Set and forget. Includes everything. Just add water. Great for juices, smoothies, and more.
Exactly.
But that's a pretty five pack.
So yeah, so you have gotten into this whole scheme of how do you position yourself well on Amazon, clearly.
Yes. Well, I said we wouldn't buy reviews, but we will definitely use the long keyword titles because yeah, it'll help you get found on organic search.
Okay. Okay, so once I set up one of these, how long until it's ready for me to be grazing on wheatgrass?
About 10 days.
10 days.
Depends on temperature, of course, but 10 days is about as long as it ever would take.
And so then for the cook side of us here, what do I use wheatgrass in? Like, what can I do when I've harvested it?
Well, wheatgrass is a pretty niche product, I'd say. People love it for juicing, smoothies. As a, you know, amateur chef, I'd say. I have used it in other things. I made a peach milkshake. It might sound like a weird combination, but the kind of
you are the peach state, so, you know, that fits.
The slight funkiness of the wheatgrass works pretty well with peaches, I think.
So you wouldn't eat wheatgrass by itself. Is it funky tasting? Is that...
I actually like it. It's sweet and it's grassy. It reminds me a little bit of like that fresh cut lawn kind of taste.
Okay.
Or smell. You can taste it.
I was going to say, that was going to be my follow up question, Ron.
Are you eating grass? But if you've ever had wheatgrass, you've probably gotten it in a refrigerated section in a grocery store if you buy it fresh. But when you actually grow it yourself and there's actually water underneath it, it is like more hydrated. It's a little sweeter too. And sometimes, you know, we have a bunch of them testing around the office. I'll take a little bit and chew on it. It's very sweet, actually. It's sweeter than you'd expect.
Yeah. And the whole purpose, like wheatgrass is a bit of a specialty food. Most people treat it like a supplement almost because it's just very dense in vitamins and minerals. So a lot of people will juice it and then take like a shot of the juice and like do one of those every day or something, you know.
So now the hope with this is obviously it's a lot more accessible to people because what is it, $5?
Yeah.
Price point, it's a lot more accessible. You're hoping to get bigger distribution, get more kind of people into the fold of growing stuff. Is then the hope to convert some of these people into kind of the bigger farm, the nano farm, later on down the road?
Definitely. There's only limited things you can grow with the light that comes in your window. So I think if you want to be able to grow the kind of greens you're used to buying, like salad greens and things like that,
right,
you're going to need some sort of system. But I think that there's a huge untapped market of people that want to grow things easily, but don't want to invest right now in a growing system. So we're trying to really get out there with this low cost product and see how many people want to try this.
Okay. Let's talk about now the startup and the startup experience at this point. So this is the first startup that you guys have founded and founded together. How big is the company right now?
Right now it's just the two of us.
Just the two of you doing all of it.
Yes.
So the boxes are handmade. When I get a wheatgrass, I know that one of you two have made it by hand. and shipped it. Okay. Any money raised from outside?
No.
No? So did you guys take the money that was a part of CreateX, the startup summer, the $20,000?
Yeah, we did take the $20,000 from CreateX.
Okay, so yeah. $20,000. The company is now, so this is what, 3 years in, 3.5 years in, something like that?
Yep.
At this point, only $20,000 in. You've got random side hustles. Are you doing jobs, like paying gigs on the side too from somebody else, or is it just random projects?
Yeah, for me, I do a little bit of freelance product design.
Okay.
And I work at a gym.
Okay. So you get to work out for free. Is that
basically
the goal there?
Yeah, okay. That's the goal.
Yeah, that was a total scam there. I work, that's in air quotes there, at a gym. What about you, Alex?
I sell on Amazon on the side, as I mentioned before, the cilantro and basil seeds.
Okay.
As a pack.
So that's the side hustle there.
And that was kind of also... just to familiarize myself with Amazon, because, you know, I was there, I'm in the entrepreneurial world. Amazon's a big part of that.
Right.
So I wanted to kind of just clear up a blind spot in my vision.
Okay, let's talk about so you've been doing this for three and a half years. I'm sure there have been a lot of lessons, a lot of things that have gone wrong along the way. Talk to me about some of those. Like, what do you wish you would have known then that you know now that you would have done differently back then?
Oh, man. There's a lot. Knowing the importance of marketing. As two engineers, as many times as we've been told this is not the case, we kind of had a bit of the, like, build it and they will come kind of mentality. You know, like, you make something cool enough, if it works well enough, that's enough to launch your product.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when we went into our Kickstarter, we knew we'd have to do some, like, publicity and things like that. But we didn't know. Like, we thought that it being on Kickstarter was enough in itself, you know?
Yeah.
Like, people would say, oh, they'd find it on the scrolling. And then the second day into our Kickstarter, we're, like, way off the first page already, you know? So, like, you have to hit, like, load more, like, three times before you get to our product.
Right. Because you and everybody else said, hey, that's how you fix things, right? You do a Kickstarter. Yeah. And so everybody's there.
I don't know how I didn't know this statistic before launching our campaign, but there are... over 5,000 active campaigns at any time on Kickstarter.
And we did a lot of research too, and we missed a few things.
Yeah.
I had no idea it was 5,000 active at any time.
Probably well more than that now.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So but you did the Kickstarter.
Yeah.
It was successful in the end of it, right? It completed.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Okay.
It was successful. We had hoped that it would like really blow up, you know? Like,
right.
You know those Kickstarters that make like $500,000 or $1 million?
Right.
Like, in the back of our minds we were hoping, because that would have given us the scale to make the nanofarms at a really good price point.
Right. So how much were you trying to raise with the Kickstarter, and what did you actually raise?
Well, our goal is 50,000.
Okay.
And we raised 62.
Yeah, I think the challenge is, and I think that's a challenge with a lot of things that are related to startups, is we only hear about the good ones, right? So you hear about like
survivor
movement
bias.
That raised $1 million, $2 million and now sold for, you know, $400 million, or, you know, Facebook started out of a dorm room and you know, multi-billion-dollar. Like, you don't hear about all the ones that absolutely miserably failed, which is the vast majority of all those.
And there were probably five startups in my dorm room.
How many startups?
And not in my dorm room, but in my on my floor in college. There are a few startups there. And
on one floor.
Yeah, just on one floor.
Right.
And, you know, they're all gone now.
Yeah.
You don't hear about them.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's probably part of the challenge, right? Is that you never hear about the ones that didn't go anywhere quickly.
Yeah.
But they did exist, but, you know, they're part of the stats. So what else did you guys learn that you wish you'd known then that you know now? Have you guys ever tried to hire anybody? Did that go well, poorly?
The most we've tried to do in terms of hiring is have interns. So we did it's an internship program from Georgia Tech. They get class credit and, you know, they get experience working at a startup.
So that means you didn't have to pay them, or did you pay them?
No, no pay.
No pay. Yeah. So they got class credit, so you didn't have to pay them.
Yeah. I guess the lesson that we learned from that is that if you need something done, you need to pay someone,
right.
Basically.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it was great to have them around, and they did, you know, do some great work, but you couldn't give them like a task they had to do, you know?
So was the urgency not there? Is that what the issue was, or was it?
No, they cared. When you have like an unpaid internship like that, even if you're getting credit, you want to try to make it a good experience for them. So that means you can't tell them to sit in this room for 8 hours and do manual labor over and over. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So you got to keep it like interesting R&D tasks.
Educational.
Educational. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we haven't had any of the woes of actually hiring people. I've heard that's it can be difficult.
It can be challenging. Yeah. What about raising money? Have you guys ever thought about raising money?
We've thought of it.
We haven't gone past the thought of raising money.
Yeah, and what holds you back? What keeps you from progressing down that thought?
Honestly, I think it's because we want to find better product market fit before raising money.
Okay.
I still
feel like you don't have it.
I think we're finding it. We get people to buy our product. We're selling products, you know? But I think more needs to line up before... Let me phrase it this way. Like, if we had raised money way back when we were first thinking of raising money, I think we would have gone way off course.
Okay. You think you would have spent the money on a path that didn't make sense?
Exactly.
Yeah. And you would have maybe... Definitely. Not realize that because you had the money to spend?
And then because we had invested in, you know, tooling and manufacturing supplies and
right.
complex supply chain to get, say, just the nano farm, you know, we couldn't have, like, lightly pivoted over to, like, the nano farm pro.
Right.
Or the wheatgrass boxes, you know?
Yeah.
So I think we feel a lot more light on our feet before taking on a bunch of money. We are definitely not opposed to raising money. I think the right time is when orders are coming in, we're hustling to move product, and we're struggling to keep enough product in stock. And if we just had the cash, we could, you know, 10x the whole operation, you know,
okay.
overnight.
Yeah.
I think that's probably going to be the right time.
You guys are a really good example of the make a $5 mistake, not a $5,000 mistake phrase that you hear a lot. Because you could have, you know, spent a ton of money on this initially when you didn't have that perfect product market fit.
Yeah. I mean, and there's no telling, I guess, whether more money would have made it work. But I think that if you bootstrap a business, like Alex and I were just talking about this the other day. If you bootstrap a business and it is growing and you look at the metrics and it's growing at a good rate on its own sales, then pouring more money in, it almost guarantees that it's a business model that it's going to work. You know what I mean?
Right.
If you put money in first and you're moving along, it doesn't guarantee that it's going to scale.
You're not forcing it on people. People are going and seeing it and seeing your, you know, marketing and stuff and saying, this is what I want, because we found a good product market fit.
Right.
And I think the other benefit behind being small like this is that your early community of like early adopters is extremely tight knit and smaller. And smaller for an early adopter community can be better because you can keep more one-on-one contact almost with them and hear what their experiences are with your products directly.
Okay. Any last piece of parting advice for entrepreneurs, aspiring entrepreneurs out there?
So we've been doing this for over 3 years now. I think the number one piece of advice is just don't give up.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And it's a lot easier to do that when you have a direction you're headed in, when you know what that direction is. And it's easier to do that with a partner that you can tolerate being around for 8 hours a day.
And ideally that you can celebrate your birthdays with.
Yes.
Every year. So.
Exactly.
Well, Alex and Ruwan, thanks for being on the podcast. Listeners, you heard it here. Don't give up. Keep going forward. We'll talk to you next time.